more. Baby, it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, no doubt when you see you are. Right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight, but she did participate in this second hour we're rebroadcasting that we did with Nikki Rapana a number of years ago. Our first hour was with Patrick Wood, author of Technocracy Rising. And we want to thank Patrick. Thanks for doing that fine interview with us. We understand a little bit more about technocracy versus tectonic era that Brzezinski wrote. But you tied all of that together so beautifully and insightfully. We want to thank Patrick Wood, author of Technocracy Rising, our guest for that first hour. This is not an easy thing to figure out. That's why I rebroadcast during this next hour, after I make these comments, the Nikki Rapana interview. She goes way back in discovering communitarianism. And Patrick Wood, in his book, in Appendix Number 1, had a treatment of Peter Drucker coming out of Austria and becoming a naturalized citizen and eventually impacting the corporate area in control and management techniques that they had never received before. But also, according to Patrick Wood, he had a profound effect on the churches, which gave rise to the mega churches, and especially these large churches with a concept of communitarianism. Now, communitarianism is, simply put, is something that has precedence. It gives precedence to community rights over individual rights. You've seen the rise in the formation in Austin here of these neighborhood groups. Well, that's a really good example of what we're beginning to depict as a technocracy in action, where you have not only people that are sufficiently versed in the technology that is out there today, but also they've been schooled in a communitarian view, which means that their neighborhood group should have precedent and should have more rights than any individual living in that area. And so they're beginning to impress upon the members in those neighborhoods certain rules and regulations and so on that really are outside sometimes of the city ordinances, see. This came in along with Agenda 21, which was a UN initiative. You can find that on the web. You can go into Wikipedia, and you can find a treatment of that. This is not an easy thing to describe because we get back to what I've always been talking about in my book that I have out now called Be Good to Yourself. I have in there, I talk about delusion, see. And delusion that I talk about is when someone tricks you into thinking and acting and controlling you in a certain way with ideas. So I see the American public, much less the world at large, having been tricked into many of these new age groups, of these new world order groups, and so forth. And that's what we're dealing with in the churches today in this country. Constance Cumby, which wrote a scathing attack book on the New Age movement, was very insightful and still is today. And I'm going to put her click-off should be up there now on her site. But she's been able to describe the dynamics of communitarian type of thinking and and Luciferian thinking and things like this. We have such a grand deception out here that when I begin to talk with friends or acquaintances or whatever, it's not an easy thing to explain. The Bible itself, and I'm not going to be preaching scripture tonight or anything, but it says the ears will not hear and the eyes will not see. What I see that has happened is that we're caught up from birth in a predisposed way of thinking into a certain worldview or political thoughts or religious thoughts and so forth. When we get older, we might look back and question some of that, but most of the time we'll never overcome that predisposed view that we were conditioned into by our parents. Our parents have been subject to the worldly, problems, to the world itself. And so they are worldly themselves, and they're suffering themselves with this worldly view that they have been taught by their parents. It's an ongoing thing. Nobody hardly breaks out of it, see what I mean? And we just all remain, like a dog chasing its tail, continually caught up in not being able to perceive some of the real issues of today and some of the real struggles and so forth of today. It's not easy in the sense that we live in a world that we're surrounded by light, okay? And so this I describe as a field system. And your physicists can explain that even into more detail than I could ever do. But in this field system, then we're exposed to streams of light that carry ideas into our minds, okay, through our eyes. And then also we have sound through our ears into our head. We record this continuously. Sometimes we have to take snapshots versus long recording because our brains could become overburdened sometimes. So we're continually exposed to a barrage of propaganda, belief systems, religious ideas, political ideas. In the school, we've got all kinds of theories and so forth that we're continually taught. We've got math that we're being taught and so forth. But all of these things together form a worldview, say. And the best man, David Noble, Noebel, up at Summit Ministries up in Colorado, probably has done the best, job in publishing a book called Understanding the Times, okay? And the reason why it is excellent, it is it explains the worldviews from supporters of those particular words or the believers of those views, okay? And that's why it's interesting is that I believe he has it divided into about six different world views now. So you can go in there and you can begin to, he has a worldview chart. And I'll just read off some of the basic world views that he has. He has about six, I believe, delineated here. He has a biblical Christian worldview, Islam, a secular humanism worldview, Marxist-Leninism worldview, a cosmic humanism worldview, and a postmodernism worldview. See? So he breaks it down into really detail, and then he takes the supporters of those and the believers and the followers of those particular worldviews and puts their words into the different chapters and explains that worldview from those that are involved in believers and subscribers to that particular worldview, see. But you can find that at summit.org, summit.org, and then click off on what it says resources, then go down there to the worldview chart, and you can look at that. We have to school ourselves sometimes outside of the university system. If we remain strictly in the university system, we're going to not be able to overcome some of the, predisposed conditioned states that we find ourselves as adults. It's not wrong to have a worldview. It's not wrong to have parents that teach you and school you in a certain worldview. Christianity itself, with forgiveness and all that, is one of the most beautiful worldviews that you can be schooled into and can adopt and start believing in that. One thing about Christianity, about the teachings of the divine, I would say teachings of forgiveness, is that it really forms to me a release from our slavery. That's why I believe the forgiveness that Christianity has at the core of its teachings, I think, is supreme and very divine. It's a very divine teachings. So if we could only grasp and begin to take hold of some of those views, then we might be able to come out of what I call a delusional state. And a delusional state would be one where you're continually chasing your tail, the dog chasing his tail scenario, and you're not really going to overcome the slave state of the thought slavery, I could say. I guess W.G. Wells said something like that, thought slavery is the way he was saying. We have all these elitists running around all over the world, and they dreamed up ways to control us, and they put out new ways of thinking and new worldviews, and they create new religions and all that, you know. But the world is not any better now than it was hundreds or thousands of years ago. We have a lot more knowledge, and we have high technology, and that's why this Technocracy Rising book during the first hour is important to listen to. Go back and listen to it at thesecrettruth.com. But we must begin to see that this field system that we're embedded in, with all these streams of light and all these people influences that we have all the time, are overwhelming in scope. And they overwhelm us to where we can't really begin to think outside of that system of thinking, see. When I started writing and thinking, I would walk along Town Lake, and I would say, hey, what is this world all about, and what am I all about? And I began to come out of it. It took years to walking up and down and jogging around Town Lake to begin to look at myself and know thyself. That Greek saying of Socrates that he used to teach, that is all important, but it's very, very difficult to attain and understand who you are. The problem that it's hard, that the reason why it's very difficult to understand, is we have this thing called ego or whatever, and this image of who we think we are, this self that we're dealing with, this self image, and usually it's not a very accurate view. We have an inflated view sometimes, an overly puffed view, an overly grandiose view. We suffer grandiose delusions of grandeur, maybe, if you take it to a psychotic stage of some kind. But anyway, all of us think more about ourselves than people sometimes think about us. Our friends, we need to ask them, what's wrong with me? I mean, your way of thinking. What's my bad points? What are my good points? We need to begin to start coming out of this deluded state of being in touch with what I believe is a false self. I believe that what we have come to believe and we communicate with and think of, and this image, that this self-image that we have, is what I would describe as a false self. And I think it splits off upon shortly after birth, and I think the worldly views our parents are seeding into us and inducing into us creates a breaking off effect into this new altar personality. And I'd say that altar personality is what I would describe or name as a false self, see. So most of our lives we're dealing with this self-image, but I don't think it's the best image that we could have, see. And I believe that when you begin to walk in the spirit of forgiveness, you're integrating a faith-based and a works-based ideas of how to go to heaven, see. And in that walking in that spirit of forgiveness, you're reflecting to others who you are. But also what's most important about it is you're teaching your family and your children how to become a better person through forgiveness of self and others. When you can truly overcome this hate and resentment that we harbor in all of our hearts, we by degree, I'm not saying everyone out there is hateful or resentful, but I'm just saying by degree, we harbor certain resentment-based and hate-based systems that we need to try to overcome, say. You have to look back at yourself and forgive yourself for the transgressions that you committed against others. But also you must ask others to forgive you too, see. I think the 12-step program has about three of those steps have to do with making amends and so forth, so on. And that's why it works, see. Because it's a release, see. Forgiveness is a path towards enlightenment. And my definition of enlightenment is when you are no longer a thought slave and you love the world, you love yourself, you love your fellow man, but you harbor no resentment and hatred for anyone. That doesn't mean that you don't just all of a sudden give up on prosecuting people who are guilty of murder or whatever. We're not talking about that. That's justice. We're talking about your own personal relationship here. Yourself and the world. And the Solzhenitsyn said, the battle line between good and evil runs through every human heart. So it is up to each individual to overcome the negatives and the weaknesses that we find ourselves succumbing to. So we've just got to work on this and not give up on it. Well, moving on to some news. Well, Clinton finally handed over the server. One of her attorneys said it's wiped clean. I don't know what that means. You've got to really wipe these things clean, to get everything off. The FBI is examining it now. There was classified data on one of her servers back in May, and they gave her a safe for her attorney or something. And so this is an ongoing thing since then, at least. She should have never had any classified information. She should have never communicated any State Department except for personal things on anything other than government email. When she went off and got her own server and got her own email, that opened it up to being hacked. So there again, the security of those communications was susceptible to being hacked and being intercepted and so forth by our enemies. I have different people. I ask them, well, is this email thing going to hurt her to where she'll no longer be a contender for the Democratic nomination? And people said, well, she's on the inside track. No, she'll shake it off. Other people say, yeah, this is it, because some of the information on her servers came from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which occupies the third largest building in the Washington, D.C. area. And so this is some of the most, and signal intelligence also. There were imaging coming from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and there was signal intelligence that was involved in one of the emails. So this is there. She says, no, none of it was labeled. Well, these inspector generals now are saying, yes, it was labeled, and it comes from those particular agencies, or signal intelligence, or the spatial imaging intelligence, which is also some of the most highly classified, material and documents that you're ever going to handle in security. And I did a little bit of security work when I was in the Army and Army Security Agency. And so this is what we're up against now. She is, and she just got to work it through. The FBI is into it now, so it's not good, from her viewpoint. But I'd say the main thing that's happening is I think the audience, the public, that once supported her with overwhelming confidence, I think they've lost confidence in her, and the trust I think has been broken. So I think there's public trust that's been broken, and I don't think they're just as confident in her as before because of all of these problems of not securing this material, the classified material and so forth. according to the State Department rules, plus the U.S. government rules, but in addition, she shouldn't have ever had it on a private server outside of the State Department servers, which were highly secure, see. So this is what's going on there, and I just don't see now, moving on, Trump is out there. He's got big buses up in Iowa. People are surrounding the buses and saying, well, who are you? And then a staff member gets off the bus. Trump's not even on the bus. And some of the Iowans said there's hundreds of people surrounding the bus sometimes when it pulls up to a restaurant or something, and Trump is not even on there. But some staff member is, and that's how some people in Iowa are an awful excited about Trump's candidacy. I can't support him at this point. I mean, I think he's a wheeler dealer, and he's an opportunist, but I think he's beginning to take himself serious about his ability to win the nomination. Now, Pat Buchanan said that they're planning on taking him down, the power base of the Republican Party. Look, what's coming up in just a few seconds is our second hour with Nikki Rapana. Thank you very much.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We have a really fine guest with us tonight. Her name is Nikki Rapana, and we're bringing her to you live from Alaska. And she's quite a very unique lady. She's a 51-year-old first-generation Alaskan grandmother, co-founder of the online research project known as the Anti-Communitarian League, author of 2020, design and builder of Jurities, and the co-owner of a small web writer business in rural Alaska called Alaskan Web Writers. Welcome to our program, Nikki Rapana.
Thank you, George.
I'll tell you, is it really cold up there?
No, it's only about 10 below, I think.
Oh.
So that's not cold for sure.
I tell you, you're a feisty lady. You know that? You're a tough lady, Nikki. Have you been doing okay? Have you been going on a lot of radio over the last few months or what?
You know, probably more than, quite a few shows, like four or five. And I'm learning from them, and, you know, I'm more open to it, George. As I said, you know, it's all part of, you know, when you do the kind of work that I do, you don't really do it for yourself, okay? So that's a given. But in the same token, I always felt like it shouldn't be promoted, that I didn't want to push it on people.
Yes, I see.
You know, because it's just, it's hard. I'm finding that the people that have no strong religious faith or any real strong spiritual understanding for themselves, okay, they become very unhappy and depressed, and I feel a huge responsibility about that. You know that I don't have. I'm the messenger of the worst news you've ever heard. You know, so
people fall into a comfort zone of existence, don't they?
Well, I a lot of the ones I'm dealing with right now are young teenagers, young adults. You know, from 18. You know, actually younger. I'm high school kids that are already, you know, way ahead of the game than I was. You know, because I came into it with so much preconditioning. I was about 42, you know, when I found out about communitarianism and saw the first plan that got me going. You know, I had already lived a pretty free life. I'd made a lot of good choices and bad choices. I had children. You know, I had a life. And I also believed that I was in charge of that life, that everything that I did was because of the doors that opened, because I showed up for them, you know, things like that.
Sure.
Where these kids right now, that, you know, what do you do when you're just graduating from high school and you're looking for a career or a college or, you know, a union to join or whatever, you know, options, the military that are there. When you understand communitarianism and you don't want to participate or give any more power to the system than they've already taken from you, it closes a lot of doors.
Yeah, this is a real sleeper type of system of thinking and thought, isn't it? Does it try to reconcile communism with capitalism? Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, I think, and based on the evidence that I've seen, I think that capitalism and communism were both created to bring us to a synthesis called communitarianism. And we're there. Yes.
Yeah, you're so, saying that it goes way back then. It's not just something recent that Etzioni came up with. It precedes him by quite a few decades or even centuries. Is that what you're saying?
You know, the term itself popped up all the way back into ancient Babylonia when the rabbis used communitarian law to, you know, monitor, I guess, the community. However you want to put that, you know what I mean? It's community government. It's a very small concept. It can be. It's a collective way of living. It's a group think. It has all of the communist things that we're used to hearing, okay? But Marx and the whole Marxist ideology took God out of the picture, where communitarianism puts God back into the picture. This is a moral system. They use all kinds of things like persuasion and shaming and, you know, they'd much rather embarrass you into doing what they want you to do than have to put a gun at you, you know. They'll try everything.
It sounds very cultic, is it not?
I think it has elements of all of the cults that are associated, you know, because one of the things that just astonished me last spring, was to find the Communitarian Church of Vermont. And it's a pagan school called Cherry Hill Seminary. And they did write me and tell me that they're no longer associated with the Communitarian Church. But I can find no record or evidence the Communitarian Church ever existed. So, it pops up in weird places like that, you know? And yes, it has a lot of the school of the earth ideology, training people to become better stewards of the land, teaching us not to develop our own natural resources or try to make a living using any of the animal plants or, you know, anything that's around us. You know, I don't know how we're supposed to live. That's, you know, one of the key things too about finding out. Once you understand their control issues and how they want to control and limit your life, that's when trying to find a way out of that is, you know, it's just not an easy path, okay?
Right.
And I'm not out of it. You can't get out of it exactly, you know? So when people start looking to me for answers and saying, what should we do? I'm like, boy, I don't think you want to do what I did.
I had occasion with Charlotte Littlefield and another friend of ours, Jim, upon it to travel to Washington, D.C. in November. And up there, we looked around, and there are all kinds of institutions that sound like what you're describing.
Well, George Washington University hosts the Communitarian Network, and I have to go look this up, but I keep seeing this thing where it says Etzioni was the first professor at Washington.
That's right.
So, I don't know exactly what that means. What does that mean, that they started the college? And
I think they founded a communitarian movement there at George Washington. And he's the man that founded it there.
Well, I know he founded it. He says in one of his books, The Spirit of Community, I think it is, where the idea just popped in his head one day at lunch with Robert Galston. Or William Galston, sorry. With Robert Putnam, who they're all in there writing Obama speeches right now.
Well, you got Sal Alinsky in Chicago early on, see, that came up with this activist stuff, the father of community activism.
Yes.
See what I
yes.
mean? And from that sprang up a lot of these different people. He seeded in a lot of different people's ideas, and Hillary and Obama and a lot of others.
Mm-hmm. Just a few months ago, I started joking and saying it looked to me like all roads lead to Chicago, because a lot of the things that I study end up either originating in Chicago or they were imported from England into Chicago. Jane Addams was, you know, in after the Fabian Society.
Yes, yes.
Created their whole thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very interesting, the Fabian Society. Let's get into that English connection when we come back, because that's The Fabian Society was a socialist society created in the 1880s, and they came over here with some of those things, too. We're going to be right back, Nikki, and thank you very much for being with us this evening. We'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, and welcome back, Nikki Ripana.
Thank you, George.
The founding, let's cover one other item here before we let it slip by. The man that's accredited, Dr. Etzioni, out of California originally, wound up at George Washington. Tell us a little bit about him first before we move on to the Fabian Society.
Well, I learned about the Fabian Society from, I was reading, an older article that Etzioni wrote about, how he had been influenced, in his thinking. And he mentioned that his, membership as a Fabian had influenced his ideas of peace. So I didn't know what that was, and over the course, I don't know when I finally went and looked it up, I went, what?
Yeah, my gosh. Yeah. Well, they founded the London School of Economics.
Yes.
But you know it opened
up a whole can of worms, isn't it?
It does.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the full name of that London School of Economics is? The London School of Economics and Political Science. That's the total name.
Yeah. And see, the thing that I didn't understand going in, and, you know, I don't know if I ever make this clear in my writing or not, is that I didn't know. I thought, okay, the world had changed since the American Declaration of Independence was signed. And you know, I was raised believing that ideal, you know, of inalienable rights was promoted a huge surge in changing in people. I thought the change had already happened, okay?
Right, okay.
Yeah, and that most people believe in equal rights under the law, you know. I just thought that. So it was pretty astonishing to me to start reading Fabian Society and all of the academics associated with, you know, that whole, I read the Frankfurt School now, I've read, you know, all the Jesuit schools before they shifted, you know, and history of the Middle Ages and how they changed that. I've had to read a lot of their stuff. And what I finally grasped was that they believe that they are born to rule, that the men must be governed, you know, that they can't ever be left to their own free will, okay? Then they have all these different theories to back themselves up on why they are the chosen ones. And it's not even so much a religious thing, I don't think, with them. I think it's just an arrogance.
It's a man God thing, and it's arrogance and it's power.
Power. Yes. But I'm just thinking, you know, I don't know what motivates them, okay? I wouldn't know if it was a cult or, you know, because I don't know what Etzioni belongs to or who he prays to, you know. That's never really come up. Except for, I mean, obviously he's a Jewish man, so he would profess that faith, you know what I mean? But even when people cloak themselves behind religions a lot, and so I really don't look at what they say about their religion. I look at what they do, because their actions and what they are part of is more important to me than what they profess they believe in. You know what I mean? That's where I go with that.
In my studies, I've always come up with the people behind these groups, whether it's the Fabian Society or it's this movement, this communitarian movement. The big money is behind those movements and controlling them. That's and they're bringing about a collective type of state, because they can more easily control that, because it's statism and more power to the government over the individual. See what I mean?
Yes. But it's cloaked in we need to give more. We all need to make certain sacrifices.
Well, in this case, it's community rights over individual rights then, right?
Yes. And that, you know, that if you don't give up your individual rights to help the community, then you're a bad person. so
then you're not you're not a good person, and you're not an asset, and you don't, maybe you're anti-government or you're against us. Is that the feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much against us that they don't care about that. They don't really expect you to be against them. They're really kind of shocked, you know. I don't know how many meetings you've gone to, but when you don't agree with what they're doing, they're like, what do you mean you don't agree with us?
I've never been to one of their meetings, because I don't subscribe to a collective type of political system, see? I mean, I subscribe back to the original Constitution, Bill of Rights, and you know, the Declaration. But,
well, that's
but
why they're
getting
away with it, because Americans don't go to meetings to determine public policy. There's nothing, you're never taught that in any school I've ever been in where they said, okay, we are built as a Soviet, and you must go to your local Soviet meeting on a regular basis, or you don't have a say in what happens in your neighborhood, your city, your county, or your nation, you know? And they're building a whole parallel system of government
now,
right alongside ours.
Now, I can't say I can't say I haven't been to a meeting. I went to a meeting where they did zoning. See, planning and zoning. This is part of their techniques. Is that true?
That's how I got involved, was in the land management.
Now tell us how you first got aware of this.
Well, I was living in Seattle, and my landlord owned somewhere around 70 properties in an area that this city was working with, you know, big time planners to put in a light link rail transit system. That was a big fiasco, lots of missing money, a lot of head rolls in the Puget Sound Light Link Rail group. I think they lost like $500 million or something, you know. I mean, it's all about tests and then, you know, gathering information on areas that you can get cheap houses. They were targeting a lot of elderly and doing them one at a time. So when they came up against my landlord, and he owned so many properties, there was a real land war going on. And I offered to help him a little bit, figure out some things, you know, where some of the authority was coming from. And the more I dug into it, the more insane it got. I had to stop and learn how to read a land management plan and study all the acronyms and learn all the city agencies and the county agencies and the federal agencies. And then I started following the money. And, you know, you can follow it all the way to England, even from your neighborhood plan, you know. So along the way, trying to find the reasoning for the stuff that they were saying. They had told me that my rights were balanced, that there was no longer a Fourth Amendment the way that I thought it. In fact, they told me all the rights I thought I had under those first main 10
right.
were had been balanced, they told me. And they use that word a lot, balance, you know, and so,
in other words, we've got to balance the individualism against the community needs and rights. Is that right?
They told me that sacrifices needed to be made. They told me that 10 years ago in Seattle, and that we were the sacrifices. I said, well, what if you were the sacrifice? How would you feel about your theory is in, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And they're like, well, yeah. Nikki, I'm helping. Why are you complaining? I said, because I'm the sacrifice. So, you know, really, at that point, when you realize and you're in a plan and you're looking at the plan and you see yourself called a transient with a significant negative impact on your neighborhood, that ought to get anybody's wheels spinning a little bit.
Now, what is that again? They labeled what?
We were called transient renters.
Really?
Seattle renters were called transients with a significant negative impact on the neighborhood.
With a negative impact. Oh, my God.
Significant, you know.
A significant negative impact on the community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those community rights were greater than your individual rights, right?
Yes. They trampled our individual rights.
I got you. Let's get into that when we come back. We've got to take another break here. We'll be right back. Thank you, Nikki. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Welcome back, Nikki Rapana. Tell us about your websites here before we start getting into any further conversation.
You can get to every one of the sites that we have from nord.pwu.net. That's Nord, N-O-R-D, the web union, pwu.net. You made it real easy now.
Okay, and also I put up all those click-offs on our site tonight, this evening, so they can come into thesecrettruth.com and they can pretty well click right into all of your different sites and everything. Now, on your site, you have a free giveaway, right? A free download there. Tell us a little bit about that.
The Anti-Communitary Manifesto?
Yes, tell us about that. Yeah.
Well, that started out, that was actually the very first thing that we put online in December 2002. I was writing what I, you know, my idea of a rebuttal to Dr. Amitai Escioni. And it had started as a little tutorial for a game that we just designed for my dad. My dad was in the Army, and he was having a hard time understanding the philosophy because he hadn't ever studied any 19th century writing, okay?
Okay.
So it was foreign to him, and he didn't want to hear that bull, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So I was like, oh, no, you have to understand some of this stuff, you know? And so we designed this game called War on Words. To try it. And the, what is the Hegelian dialectic, which now is part one of the manifesto, was that first paper that we wrote, to introduce Hegel to my dad. And then I put it online and sent it to Escioni, the Communitarian Network, the American Sociological Association, because he had been president of that, the ASA in 95, I think it was. And a bunch of professors involved, sociological professors around the country, had signed an opposition statement against him. And I contacted as many of those as I could find. And I did hear back from about four or five of them, but nothing in support of me. Just, you know, giving me, people are, have been really funny about my work, you know. It's like they don't want to come out and say, keep doing it. Sometimes, well, a lot of times they do say that, but I mean, the people that are close, you know, that are in the teaching profession and have maybe a job to lose over this, they don't want to, but they don't want me to stop. So, we waited for his rebuttal, and when it didn't come, I was like, I went back in and looked up the ASA standards for an academic thesis. And so part two of the manifesto, the historical evolution of communitarian thinking, was written to ASA standards. And then I attached that and sent it out. And I still haven't ever heard from any of them. And that was, it's been, what is it now, 2009? 6 years.
So the big money is behind this communitarian thinking, is it not?
Well, the Rothschild Bank of England, through Lynn Forrester and Al Fromm, funneled the money in through the Democratic Leadership Council that helped get the Clintons into the White House. So from that, I did find all that funding from a couple of different sources, actually, that were good ones. That, you know, and that they don't hide this very much, okay? I don't know this for a fact, but I did hear that the Rothschilds, because Lynn Forrester Rothschild was an American working at a Democratic activist, I guess you'd call her, who hooked up with Sir Evelyn D. Rothschild. She managed the money, did all the stuff for them, and then they got married. And I heard that they spent their wedding night in the White House with Clintons, but I've never confirmed that, you know.
Right.
But yeah, these people know each other really well. And then Hillary, she's at all their meetings, the Bilderberg and stuff like that, you know. Yeah, they're a tight-lit little group, and someone was saying this the other day, and it's very true. The same names just keep popping up. You know, once you start reading the first few times, they're all new to me. You know, I didn't know who Sidney and Beatrice Webb were, you know. But it's funny how their name comes up.
Yeah, the Fabian,
you know?
Society.
Yes. And so I am a researcher. That was my
But they also college, they also so. Subscribe to, I think Annie Besant was a theosophist, too.
Well, that's a whole nother really creepy aspect that I didn't know who Madame Blavatsky was. I didn't know what a theosophist was, okay? So, you know, I just barely touched on that because so many, this is the problem I had. You can see it in part two of the manifesto. Right around the turn of the century, everything that I tried to find out about the American system, because I was trying to just establish how communitarianism actually came into place, you know? How did it get here? It didn't just show up one day at lunch. You know that. You know, it's too powerful.
So you were trying to research the evolution of it over a long period of time.
Yes, as far back as I was willing to go with documentation that I can actually find and verify myself. And I used as many, I used, you know, if I wanted to know about Albert Gallatin, I went to the U.S. Treasury Department websites. When I wanted to know about Jefferson, I went to the Jefferson Memorial, you know. All of the quotations and things, I used several college texts, historical, you know, textbooks, but mostly I used government websites and stuff. And so as soon as I hit the anything to do, I mean, it's really like it's the late 1800s when the Fabian Society started and they sent Jane Addams to America and Emma Goldman's out there doing her thing, getting the ACLU going, training assassins. The guy kills McKinley, who's directly connected to the Fabians in Chicago.
Right, right.
So all right night, and that was 1901. That puts Teddy Roosevelt on the throne. Now we have a British Nabob, and he brings in, you know, Gifford Pinchot, which the whole thing with the Park Service and the land, and they immediately started implementing what I see British conservation in America, which is control everything and only the elites get to use it. It's you know, it's not even that complicated.
So they've taken a lot of land out through national, what, park programs and et cetera, and other, what, UN programs, right?
Heritage sites, they call them, you know, you have wilderness areas, designated this and designated that. Then they got to have a buffer zone around the wilderness area so they can control what's going on. And that's what's happening to me right now. I live on the edge of the largest park in the United States. It's called the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, and it's an internationally protected heritage park because it also extends over the border into Canada in the Yukon Territory. And the what they're doing out here right now is they're locking up all the land. They just handed up over, you know, I mean, I live in the wilderness pretty much, okay, out here. There's about maybe a few thousand people spread out over a lot of acreage, and there's nowhere to get wood.
Really?
Yes. So, and anywhere that you go near a park, you know, I lived in Wyoming for a year. A lot of my work was actually written in Wyoming. Most of the ACL website was that winter. And, yeah, the Wyoming, they really know, you know, because of their experience with Yellowstone. They've had it. That was the first park, and it was set up as a hunting retreat for Wild Bill Cody, and the first visitor was a prince from the Prince of Wales. I don't remember his name, Albert or something. Anyway, you know, they all go hunting together, like Denali National Park up here in Alaska. That park is a hunting reserve for them. They allow you to go into certain areas. They shut down the roads, you know. So the road that I'm living in, Ron, right now, you know, I was flagging a couple years ago, you know, for a traffic on a road crew. And I had so many tourists say to me all summer long, you know, what are you doing here? We were told there were no people here, you know. So the idea that, you know, the wilderness area has to be protected, they're mostly protecting it from, you know, from us because we're not good stewards of the land. So I'm actually thinking about writing an Endangered Human Act. Have you ever heard of anything like that, George?
Yeah, not exactly. But, I mean, there's so much going on out there, Nikki. I mean, it's hard to keep track of everything, isn't it?
No. I know. I just say that they have, you know, it's like after Katrina when they...
Oh, yeah.
The people didn't have anywhere to go.
Yeah.
They need to set aside a big, huge 22-million-acre park and call it the Endangered Human Act. Area,
yeah, the Endangered, you know? Human Act. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's a good... Let's get that. Let's lobby for that, huh?
Well, you know, I'm trying to look for positive ways to put it out there.
You gotta laugh.
You know?
It's go bad sometimes. You gotta laugh. We gotta cut away. We'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Welcome back, Nikki Rapana.
Thank you, George.
This whole thing is designed to take individual freedoms and rights away. That's what I see. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that they don't believe we ever had them. And I think that they think, you know, that we're operating under an illusion that we have them. This is what's really sad to me, okay? We never had them. We don't have them. As soon as you try to exercise them, you'll find out, you know? And that's the illusion that's worked very well for keeping people in check, you know? They don't have a lot of complaints. Because because when you go to exercise your, you know, because the rights that we're talking about here are property rights. Everything is based on property rights in this country, you know. The right to do everything has to do with your
well,
rights.
Well, it's a means of wealth. Property, land itself is underlies a means to generate wealth
yes, and everything
value.
That's associated with that, that I am my property. You know, that everything that I do and create is mine to keep or to give away if I choose. And so privacy rights, what people, you know, with, other than the Fourth Amendment, you know, search and seizure laws, your right to anonymity and privacy is based in your property rights. You don't actually have a right enumerated in the Bill of Rights that says you have the right to privacy. It's not in there. It's based in everything in the whole concept of who we are as sovereign individuals. It means I'm the queen. Nobody higher, you know?
Right.
So, and we think that. Americans, oh my goodness, you know, we do. We operate like that. I mean, even the people that I know that aren't, they're not college educated, I'm working class, most of my friends from my childhood and stuff like that, you know? They got it. It doesn't take a college education.
Yeah, what was it?
The American system.
In college, they've institutionalized a system of seeding in a bunch of ignorance, haven't they? Not in condition and programming, have they not?
Yes. Well, what they've done is they turn it around. The kids get to college and they tell them, "Oh no, those rights don't exist. Your parents, they're outdated. That's a bunch of old white."
And then they start this communitarian collective cryptic Marxism or whatever you want to call it. You know.
Right, and there's a very interesting thing happened to me in the last, like, I don't know, 6 months. The National Association of Scholars started a project called No More Delawares. And that's because Delaware University had started implementing entirely communitarian regulations in the dorms and on the campus. They're regulating the students' lives like they, you know, nobody can understand where it's coming from. Well, finally, the bunch of scholars decided to start looking into it, and they found sustainability in communitarianism. And it's an amazing body of work this guy already put together, you know. Definitely a lot of research there. So if you really want to know all of the, From an academic perspective only, okay? It's this, my stuff, okay, I tried to do the academia, I wrote my thesis, and then I went right back to being a mad American, you know?
Right, okay.
Whatever I want. So people used to go, "Well, your work is so full of, you know, you need to tone it down." I go, "No. You know, I'm giving you..."
You need to turn it up.
You know, you want to read it said nicely, go read them. Go
get programmed back in the college. Go take some graduate courses and pile higher, deeper, PhD, right?
Yeah, well,
get a PhD, right?
Yeah. Yes, go get a PhD. I had, there was a PhD that came to visit me. Early on, I did a whole lot of, I was very interested in the mapping portion that the police were using and how it tied into unemployment and all of the other programs, like the new health care programs, you know, for they have what they call mental health officers and community policing services and stuff. So I was really looking at the records that these people were keeping on the people in the neighborhood associated with the maps. The program's called Compass.
Okay.
And this ties into Obama, the asset-based community development people that backed him, and that what they're doing and with the community surveys and things like that, this all tied into them. You know, so that was my real focus when I started, was the police. Because they come, when the community developers and the community associations come to the door to do the interviews to see how you can help the community, they do bring the cops. But they're not always dressed like cops. And most people are familiar with the program now anyway. Around the country, the community service officers have their own little white car, you know. And they're the one that you call if it's not really violent yet and you're just reporting on your neighbor barking dog, maybe, or people are arguing, or those kids look kind of dirty over there, you know. And
yeah, we got to look into this. Those look dirty face.
Yes.
You know.
So
they're up to something. They're playing in the mud, Nikki. You know, they can't
well,
do that.
You know, this city of Seattle, and they were doing an interdepartmental training, cross-training program between seven city agencies that have access to private homes in Seattle. And they were trying to get every agency to list their top 10 life-threatening things that could be witnessed inside someone's home on one of these routine visits. And I followed the back and forth from the city attorney's office to the different agencies that were just so uncooperative, you know? Because,
right.
Again, Americans will not go along with this. They don't like it. And there were a couple of the King County Public Health inspectors that were at one of the very first small meetings that I went to, a planning meeting, approached me outside and after the meeting and asked me to please keep asking questions and keep going. And they freaked me out, you know.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah, they did, you know. And after that, I was like, what was that? Because there was a lot of things going on in that meeting. And mainly what they were doing was looking for ways to ticket people for nuisances, okay, noise.
To generate income for the city, right?
Well, no, because if you can start targeting people as nuisances, then you can eventually build a case and take them to the through a hearing and review process, get an abatement against the property and get the land.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
So it does always go back.
Start accumulating some, elements of what? I got you. Complaints and build a case and start. I got you. Okay.
Right, and they always say that the community wanted this. The community wanted this. People from the community were complaining and things like that. Yeah, and like they have a landlord training act. They implemented this, I think, down in Burien before I left. Maybe Auburn too. That where they train the landlord to, it's a pre-screening for your tenants and turning over the information about the applicants to this community council who then determines whether these people can move into the neighborhood or not. I mean, they wanted to regulate, rental housing as a business and then require you to get certified, take classes, start their whole bureaucratic system that they just love to pile on. As soon as they get control of something and can regulate it, then you have to, that's what I mean about your rights, you know. So I walked in there to the meetings thinking that I had clear fundamental liberties that could not be infringed, and they're looking at me like, what are you talking about?
Right.
Well, I started off.
Hey, you're out of it, lady. Yeah, get out. Good luck. Yeah, God bless. Now hit the door. Right?
What rock did you crawl out from under?
And don't let it hit you on the way out, right?
Well, they did write what my friend Abby Frankenfield called it, the No More Nikki Rapana policy.
Really? No More Nikki Rapana policy. Oh, my gosh. You're generating all kinds of ordinances and decorations.
Well,
idiots, right?
It was a contentious time, I'll tell you.
Well, it sounds like it. It should have been.
Well, they wanted to come in my house and inspect it for health and safety. And I was a private renter. I was like, get out of here. You don't get to come in my house and inspect it for anything. You know, unless I got a fire. I mean, I don't fight with the fire department. I love, firemen.
They want to come in there and look around and then see, and then maybe lodge some complaints against
you.
Well,
I thought they were going to be spying because the program was designed for them to report any of these stupid, these 10 life-threatening things. They couldn't get it passed. They couldn't get it through. Nobody was participating. So they dropped it down to 5.
Five, really?
Yeah, because they couldn't find 10 life-threatening things, you know?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I tell you, this thing is, is it out of control?
Well, no, they're very, very organized about it. It's not out of control at all.
I mean, they're really pushing this stuff. They're continuing to work towards their goals, right?
Yeah, I think we're there. Obama's president.
I got you. Hey, we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back. We've got about an 8-minute break at the top of the hour, so take care of business, and we'll be right back at 6 after the hour. Thank you very much, Nikki Rapana. Appreciate you being with us this evening.